Buonasera, buonasera a tutti. Hello everyone. I'm very happy to be here tonight with Bruce Sterling and Yasmina Tesanovic. We can make a round of applause for them. The next hour we are gonna talk and listen and probably see something about art and AI, and I have to confess I tried to prepare myself a little reading and I was like running late to arrive here because I was still playing with Dali in my newsroom. So it's gonna be fun. I have some questions. Maybe the number one question is, should we add a label to AI generated art, or should we know, or should not, shouldn't we know about who did this? And but this is just the first question I have. We're gonna listen to you now, and then we have some minutes to talk and receive your question too. So thank you.
Okay, hello everybody.
All right, yeah, I'm live. We are Bruce and Yasmina. Thanks for having us at the Biennale. We're very happy to be here. We're from Share Festival in Torino, which is another technology art festival here in the city, and we're the art director and the curator.
Okay, so I'll speak in English because we have a conversation. This festival is called Tecnologia e Umanità, no? And he's going to be Tecnologia. He'll pretend to be the robot, and I'll pretend to be a woman. Here we go. Yes, and we are Globalisti a Torino, meaning many years ago we came to Torino. He is a Texan, and I'm a Serbian, and we found this place, really the best place for both of us to live and accept our eccentricities. From, you know, literature through art, politics, and technology, of course.
Right. So this year, AI generative art has taken off in a major way. And in the past 6 months, this has really been the wildest year that artificial intelligence has ever had. And, you know, it started in 1956, and there were various efforts at it. And then in 2012, deep learners arrived. But now the generative art scene is here, and that's what we're going to be talking about, because we've been spending quite a lot of time with people in this scene. So this is the generative art application landscape. These are all new companies, scarcely any of them even a year old, and here you can see them appearing all over the map. People are just throwing generative AI at all kinds of problems, language, images, code, speech recognition, text recognition, generative video. But we are particularly interested in image generation because we have this role at Share Festival where we have to be art judges.
So, as curator and art director, we have to take care of all these buzzwords. You know, last year it was NFT, even the astrologers made their NFTs, you know, and then it just disappeared. They become obsolete so fast that it's incredible. Artificial intelligence, as our introducer said, is something that few people know too much, or you know, I know very little, but I do try to understand. And I know that this year, when for our new Share Festival, we have to be aware of it because we are art and technology festival. So we will have artists proposing, it's an international festival, proposing us their works, of course also in with artificial intelligence. Now, being the jury, we sit there and we watch hundreds and hundreds of these artworks, you know, and we try to be fair, because there is a very thin line between an artwork and something completely random, nonsense, when it comes to, you know, this card of technological work. So in order to make the things more easy, for our audience, because then we see like sick works and they're like presented as a show. For the past few years, Bruce and Chiara Garibaldi, the art director, the art producer of our festival and one of the founders, they decided, and we thought it was a great idea, to invite the Torinese artists mostly, but then it doesn't mean that you have to be from Torino, you can be, but they're Italian mostly artists, and to deliver them some kind of bags. It's called Art Maker Bag. The Art Maker Bag contains tools, technological tools. The first year there was, for example, an Arduino. And most of these artists are like somebody with very classical background. You know, they are painters or sculptors or musicians. But we ask them to produce an artwork with new technologies. We train them. I mean, not me in particular. I'm just saying. And I must tell you, as a curator, that the last year when we saw the show, it was in Artissima Off, you know, this year, I don't know how it's called. Every year we have it also. It was also in Politecnico last year, no, the show. Last year's, the show of this artist based in Italy that we follow was, if not equal, better than the artist that we have in the official show, and I think it's a really big, success.
Yeah, I mean, this is our philosophy as curators. We want to understand the tools and understand the means of production and these, you know, technology art approaches. And I actually think that's the Turinese approach to technology art. Here in the Biennale, that's kind of the philosophy. Toolbox co-working is like that. Arduino and the open source electronics here in town is like that. The Fab Lab is like that. Share Festival is like that. In fact, all of Torino is like that. And in Turinese society, people like to pick up the tools and get to work. So these are some of the tools. I mean, Midjourney, Crayon. I like Crayon quite a lot because it's kind of simplest. And there's a long tradition of generative art in Torino. I mean, it did not begin with artificial intelligence. This guy, Brian Eno, he's probably the most famous generative artist in the world. So this is him 10 years ago here in Torino doing a generative music installation inside the Venaria Reale. So there he is in all his Eno-ness. He arrived. There's a huge social media thing associated with this. Millions of photographs online. The album, the record I was playing earlier before we started speaking, that's the Eno record, which is called Luke's, 10 years old now. And it was inside the Venaria, and we know Eno, so of course we went. We're on pilgrimage to the Venaria. So, you know, this shows it can happen here, definitely. This is Casey Rees. He's one of the founders of Processing Foundation, which is a generative code. They're not AI art. This is a different form of generative open source code, but he's an extremely respected guy, Casey Rees. He was here in Torino.
So speaking about Brian Eno, I think the installation he did in Venaria Reale was some 10 years ago or something, yeah? And I remember that when he made this design, it was one thing. And then when he came to Torino and he went to Venaria Reale, he redid it completely on the spot, you know, because it is something that obviously is some kind also of, how to say, performance art, no? And 2 years ago, I think we saw him and he asked, is it still there? And I said, to tell the truth, I don't know, because there is one of the problems, how to keep this kind of art visible, how to storage it, you know, archive it. And I remember also very well when I did this little video, I went there and I was doing the video while, you know, there were just little loudspeakers on the side, but they reacted to how you walk. I don't know, have you been there? I guess you have, you know. Depending on how you walk, how you moved, and they generated music this way. And I remember when I was there, I made this little video. It's nothing special on Vimeo. It had so many hits. But I also remember the people who were there with us were not alone. There were millions who passed, were not understanding what was going on. They didn't understand that they were making it with their bodies, you know. And, you know, Brian Eno is most, 60, how many years, you know, he's doing this kind of stuff. He, as Bruce said, he's probably the most famous and the earliest adopter of this kind of generative music. And I read recently in New York Times an interview, not an interview, a text about how when he was working with the other musicians in his band, as a producer, as a musician, he always had this kind of conflict because he wanted to do this kind of music while the other were doing the real music, you know. And only after 60 years, he proved that, you know, he did something. As far as Casey Rees is concerned, when he came here as an artist for our Share Festival. What I was amazed was to see Massimo Banzi and all other Arduino people come to Casey Rees and look at him as a god, you know, because he was this kind of coder many years ago, you know. And I want to mention another person, which is Leah. Leah is an artist from Vienna, and she's been very often on our show selected. She was also the member of the jury. Consistent from the very first day, and Sherry is from 2004, making this kind of generative art, which we found beautiful, but it was very hard to explain why is it beautiful, because it's so random, you know. She knew it, and what we have now to know is how to know what is art and what is not art. You know, I personally think I know it, but I'm not sure I can explain it to you because you will know something else.
Well, we're going to do our best. In the case of Eno here, yeah, he's had a 50-year career. I mean, he was a rock star in the 1970s. But even though he's now Professor Eno and like teaching at design school, he's still a member of the avant-garde. And, you know, this is from 10 years ago, but to do site-specific generative art is actually a very interesting thing that hasn't happened much. So here we are messing about with some generative art just to see what it's going to do. And this is kind of the meat of our speech here. So you can use these tools and services, and we use the tools and services, not because we're artists, but because we're trying to understand where the grain of the material is. I mean, what's good about it? What's the art part? What's the human part? What's the technology part? And so forth. Midjourney, Crayon, Stable Diffusion, Dolly Mini. There's some that are still closed to the public that are owned by Facebook and Google. They won't let the public use them. Some of them are open source. Some of them are closed source. Some of them are for hire. Some are supported by ads. There's a politics of who uses it. Even though this scene is only a few months old, it's developing extremely fast. So, you know, we're just constantly experimenting with these images. And this one in particular is Stable Diffusion, not even the public Stable Diffusion, but one of the earlier Stable Diffusions. And you can see that I'm telling it what to do, and I'm giving it a prompt in the Italian language here. So I typed in the instructions, which are a robot inside the Borgo Medievale of Torino. And it immediately generated this image. And you'll notice that I did not tell it what kind of robot to make, but it immediately made a medieval Italian robot. It's even a Turinese medieval Italian robot, because on its databanks, it knows what the Borgo Medievale looks like. It's not perfect, but it knows what the arches are look like, right? And then through style transfer, it just decides to take the style that it has in its databanks from the Borgo Medievale and then make a robot that resembles a knight in armor with no more instructions than these few words in Italian. But because the words are in Italian, it has Italian style. Right? So here we are speaking in English to it. How about Nefertiti, Queen of Egypt, buying spaghetti at the Italy slow food grocery? No problem. Maybe 25 seconds to create Nefertiti, the queen of Egypt, in an Italy slow food grocery. Now, if you look at this very closely, as indeed we do, you can see a lot of eccentricities, like these groceries that are behind Nefertiti are not actual brand name groceries. What those are statistically probable clusters of colored pixels, right? And if you zoom in on them, you'll see they're not really spaghetti sauce. They're not beans. They're not anything. They're just statistical blobs. You know, and Nefertiti's having some problems, especially her hands are pretty bad. But I did not ask this thing to put Turinese rimless glasses on Nefertiti. But it knows what middle-class Italian women shopping at Italy look like. And it immediately creates this graphic hybrid, just deciding what's the most probable thing.
Okay, I have to intervene here. Some years ago, I wrote a book called Nefertiti Was Here. I grew up in Egypt and was obsessed with this figure, you know. And I went to all sorts, because why? Because Nefertiti is one of those queens which is in the periods of peace of ancient Egypt and also of matriarchy. And so, of course, being a feminist who writes all the time about women, invisible women, and she's one of the queens that nobody knows anything, like Cleopatra, everybody knows everything. Why? Because once she was deposed, her figure was erased from the history. So, you know, it was a lot of work. I went to the Congress Library. I read everything. I spent years on it studying. I had, you know, all these notes, and finally I didn't know what to write. You know, many books are written, kitsch books, good books, historical books. So I sat down and I said, I am Nefertiti. I'll write it from the point of view of Nefertiti, as if because I know so much about how the world worked at, you know, 14th century BC. I knew everything around her except what was her. So I was her, you know. I said, I'm Nefertiti. And my friend, a writer and a journalist, said, how pretentious you are. But that was the only key I had, you know. And when Bruce said this blob she has around him, I know what they were eating. They were drinking beer and wine. I know how they made the beer and wine. I know the law that was functioning at the time. Women could inherit, you know, at the time. They couldn't, like in 19th century, inherit. But so I wrote from the point of view of a simple woman who ruled, you know, who was hated or not, but she had an everyday life, you know, and she was deposed. So I think these things are very inspirational. And not only inspiration, they're very useful if you are a writer, you know, if you are somebody who wants to imagine and create, or filmmaker. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you know, the assumption is that if it's computer art, it's going to be somehow futuristic. But because this thing has the common crawl database of all the images that were ever put on the internet, it has a tremendous command of art history. It has no trouble at all with ancient Egyptian images or medieval Italian images. It'll spit up any place, any time that was ever mentioned and labeled on the internet, and that's really quite a bizarre situation. And of course, it'll do stuff that looks more like ads. And I expect to see a lot of ads. I mean, just like, okay, it's a Fiat Cinquecento. Everybody in Torino knows what one looks like. Would you like to see it on Mars? No problem. Mars is great. Looks just like Mars. Got a huge database of Mars. It'll put it on Mars. It'll put it on ancient Egypt. It'll put it in the Borgo Medievale. There it is. So it's just, it's kind of happening. And you know, and it's not restricted to our screens. There's the latest issue of Wired Italia. This is a generated cover, generated AI by Midjourney. Obviously, the Wired designers like it so much, they had to put robots on the back of the magazine, too. So it's not a science fictional thing. This is already loose in the wild, and professionals are using it, and it's coming on like gangbusters. There's just a ton of it. So this is one of the odder aspects of AI generative art. I mean, this is an ability that it has called extension, which is already famous. So in extension, you take a historical figure like the beloved blue earring girl, and you simply tell the system to draw whatever is at the edge of the frame. So it just sits there and it kind of looks at it and it knows, okay, sort of, all right, it looks sort of 17th century. So it just starts inventing these objects off to the right, off to the left, things that look good in the foreground, things that look good in the background. It's not trying to improve Blue Girl or anything. But the issue with this is that there's literally no physical limit to it. You can continue to extend this picture for kilometers in either direction without ever repeating anything. And if you ask it to do it again, it does not make the same picture. It reinvents and regenerates everything with the same recombinant process with the ease of waves coming in from the sea. It just never gets tired, never runs out of invention. You can have all you want. It's very cinematic.
Yeah, I also worked in cinema, and you know, few people notice that, but you notice it, everybody notices it, but we don't know you notice it, that behind the first plane, where the famous actor, of course, you know, saying the words, you have the second plane, and a lot of people, assistants, are occupied with what do you put in the second plane. And if you do a mistake, I mean, it's a catastrophe. You know, you can put a watch in old Roman movies and that kind of, you know, or it's very important that you put a book that you notice without noticing. So it's a lot of work done, as I said before, cinematography, for writers. But now this is my serious doubt. Hearing all this enthusiasm with Bruce and seeing him spend hours on end generating images which never repeat, I was thinking, you know, is this some kind of gambling or gaming? You know, is it really useful? Is it going to be a vice for people? You know, Pasolini years on end, before many years, he said, like, why make art if we can only imagine it? You know, when I was a kid, I was imagining movies. I was really bored with the movies that I could see. And I was like imagining movies while watching the movies. Now I can literally do it. But my question is this kind of creativity good for art or not good for art? But my answer, I also already have it among a young generation, you know, where my daughter belongs to, and her even younger friend. They don't need the word art. They think it's a, you know, obsolete word. You know, what is the word art? You know, and she is a professional filmmaker who hates the word art, you know. So this is my question.
Well, you know, this is going to show up in TikTok. It's going to show up in web design. It's going to be all over YouTube. It's going to be all over game design. Because, you know, the people who are coders and, like, are generating this stuff. I mean, if you really need to generate yard goods of imaginary worlds, this thing is a great solution for you. You can just kind of spew unbelievable amounts of it. So there are areas of practice where it's going to appear. But then there are also, like, aesthetic questions, which have always been present in generative art ever since code art was invented in the 1960s. And I want to run through a few of these, because even though AI is involved in this, neural nets, deep learners, none of these earlier questions have gone away. They've never been solved, such as, who is the creator? I mean, who made this? I mean, was it Vermeer? Is it the programmer? Is it the system itself? And, you know, where is the originality? Where is the innovation? Like, okay, this is new, but where did the novelty come from? I mean, who invented it? Really, nobody invented it. I mean, it was just kind of accidentally discovered through computer science research. And then who owns the copyright, which is not a big problem here, but as soon as money begins entering the system, lawyers are going to appear, and there's going to be very similar problems as there is with music copyright, or scientific fraud, or engineers stealing blueprints from one another. I mean, none of these urges have gone away.
Well, this is a very old question, as you know, ever since Benjamin formulated what is the original, what is the copy, or Warhol made out of it.
Yeah,
very
that would be Walter Benjamin.
Yeah, Walter Benjamin.
And his Age of Mechanical Reproduction. If you're into technology art, that's kind of the first thing you need to read. Walter Benjamin's art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction has all the problems. You know, it's the core text that has the problems this thing is facing. Yeah. And this is like the Walter Benjamin nightmare here. Yeah. I mean, this is the apotheosis of a Walter Benjamin problem.
Absolutely. And Warhol, Andy Warhol, did it as an artist. You know, he proved that he can do art notwithstanding the fact that there is not one original. But that was some time ago. The fact that now these kind of things are so fast, you know, the lawyers have no idea what's going on, you know, of the copyright law. Right now, I'm in a... I won't tell you what it's about. But, you know, we have this copyright problems about a work of art, you know, because, and the lawyers don't know how, they're not trained into it. They don't know this kind of technologies, you know. So I don't think I don't think what we'll do about it. You know, I really have no idea. You know?
These are not human artists. The generators are not human artists. Even if they're drawing human beings, they don't have emotion or any particular social value. So you're not going to get a lot of emotion. You're not going to get a lot of artistic personal expressivity out of a generative system. I mean, it just doesn't have anything on its mind. It doesn't have any common sense, and it doesn't have any particular feelings.
Oh, I have an idea. I think that the rules that can be applied to this kind of art is some rules from conceptual art, you know? The concept is the real author, the one who has the concept, you know? And this is, for example, and performance art. I don't know if you know, but performance was never supposed to be filmed. You know, it was hic et nunc. You do it only once in that time for two people, for nobody, but that's it. But ever since Marina Abramovich, she calls herself the grandma of performance art, performed the performances of famous performers, this kind of thing moved on, you know. So now you can perform, you cannot do it twice, you can do it only once. But those, and conceptual art is based on concept. So who has the concept of doing one kind of generative art, one picture of them? Maybe that would be the author, but it would be very difficult to prove it in court.
There are old questions in generative art, like, does beauty actually have any rules? Like, could you program a system to draw something beautiful? And in generators, people are like trying to do that. It's very common to write a pretty girl, a beautiful girl, a very, very beautiful girl, the most beautiful girl in the world, the most beautiful girl in the universe, trying to push the thing into areas of aesthetic performance that it doesn't really know anything about, right? But, you know, if you're judges like us, you actually need some aesthetic criteria. You're actually going to have to say, when we get a tidal wave of generative stuff for Share Festival, we're going to have to figure out, okay, which ones actually deserve some public attention. And there are some images that are already famous, like this one, but this is it's sort of an instant freeze-dried cliche. I mean, nobody's ever going to frame this, put it on the wall. It doesn't belong on a T-shirt, a surfboard. It's not even pop art. What it is a demo, right? And we know it's going to come here. I mean, we're the judges. We can't solve these problems. We have to face them, and we have to, like, discuss them as best we can. And we know they're going to be here in Torino, because Torino has every kind of art. And there's no way you're not going to have image generator art. There's going to be tons, because there's free systems of it online. You can do it in a few seconds. It costs nothing. There's already hundreds of thousands of users. Tens of millions of generated images are showing up. That's just how it's going to be.
Yeah, well, you were, I think you should speak about the political aspect of to whom it belongs, or the hands. Okay,
let's just talk about some of its limitations. It's not perfect by any means. It's actually kind of perfect by its own standards, but it's not an artificial intelligence of a general kind. It has no common sense understanding. And it's especially bad with hands. You know, why is it bad with hands? I mean, why is it difficult? I mean, why is it so bad that an artist like Magnus Norden can make a work of art which is nothing except a collection of bad AI hands, right? Well, the problem is that a text-to-image generator reads text, and then it generates clumps of pixels. And all it is, really, is a statistical relationship between the text and the images that are generated. It has no eyes. It has no ears. It has no understanding of geometry. It can't count. It can't divide. All it can do is generate clumps of pixels that are statistically associated with certain clumps of words and phonemes. So in its database, it's got billions and billions of human hands that are continually moving around in space, and it's not able to resolve that like a photographer. This is what hands actually look like to a generative system. This is its authentic awareness of what these things are. And even when it's doing a pretty good job of recognizing a hand, like I'm trying to trick it here, like something else that looks like a human hand. All right, it looks exactly like a human hand, but it can't count to five. It can't count to five. It has no hands. It doesn't know what a human hand is. It has no flesh. It has no body. It doesn't find this surprising in any way.
Well, they say that one of the characteristics of human intelligence when you measure IQ is the ability to count. And, you know, and you count all the time with this kind of... Well, this is obviously, they can't do it, the artificial intelligence. But they can do many other things, like that, like of course, beauty is something that's different from time to time, and the canon of beauty are changing all the time. But what's really, I heard about, there was a lecture, and there was like predicting couples that are fantastic, artificial intelligence with that, like ideal couples. But what about love? You know, love is not something you can predict, you can control. Like in the movie Solaris, you know, when this, you know, Stanislav Lem book, you know, when your secret love materializes, and it can be a dwarf, it can be a worse enemy, you know, it's not something that... So, I mean, I think it has very... interesting lackings, and I think we may correct it. You know, we're out of corrective society, after all. We correct ourselves, you know. And maybe we're intelligent enough to correct those five hands and the counting, yeah.
Well, I don't doubt that there are methods. I mean, you could do Photoshop and just fix the hands later. I mean, the hands are not the only problem that this system has. And you might think, okay, it's the English word hand. Oh, no. The Italian word hand doesn't work any better. In fact, an Italian hand looks even worse. And then there's these political problems which immediately sprouted up. So, you know, people are going to attempt to use these and make money with them. And it's easy to just erase the hands and draw in new hands. I mean, that's not a deal breaker if you want to use generative art systems. The problem is that the database has the work of human artists in it. And they're not happy about having their work appropriated and, you know, and turned into recombinant pixel bits for a generative machine. So this is, you know, it's a controversy that's already starting.
We don't have it.
Okay, yeah. They don't have it. I mean, it's stability AI, stable diffusion, which is one we use a lot. And, you know, dividing lines are going up, and it's a very typical political situation. Money's going to change everything. There's nothing new about it. It's just going to be new in a particular way. Then you've got the major players moving in who are aware that new startups are coming. They're going to attempt to acquire them. Microsoft is folding some generative capacities into their creation systems. Adobe Photoshop is going to want to turn these systems into just one item in a pull-down menu. Some will be acquired, some will join. There'll be like national ones. There'll probably be Chinese ones that work only for the Chinese and so forth. I mean, it's a very typical political and economic struggle. The mere fact that AIs are involved and that it can draw stuff a kilometer across, that's not going to make a lot of difference.
Since we don't have the image,
we're running out of we've run out of generated images, which is funny in a lecture on generated images. Yeah. But I'm gonna seize this opportunity to deliver a technical lecture here. because it's important to understand how these things work, at least to some degree, in order to know why they behave as they do. So if you look at a typical setup like Stable Diffusion, which is an AI text image generator, it's not a simple machine. It's not one machine, it's actually usually about half a dozen, right? Which are kind of hooked one to the other. So where did it come from? Well, originally, they were not text to image generators, they were image to text recognizers. What you were doing was training machines to look at photographs and paintings and name the things that were in the paintings. But about 5 years ago, some researchers hanging around in Facebook said, what if we just turn this backwards? Instead of like getting the computer to tell us what's in the photograph, why don't we just tell it and get it to make a photograph? And it turned out that it worked. I mean, at first they were crude. They were just like little 64 by 64 things. But when they realized they could actually work, they started pouring on the heavy iron, and now they work like gangbusters. But they're still quite crude because they're really, really new. I mean, in February they couldn't do this stuff, and now they're doing video, and like 3D stuff, and like image recognition, face recognition. They're, I have never seen a new media development in my entire 67 years of life that has moved as fast as this. And it's because it's open source. All the working parts are in the cloud. There aren't any physical machines doing this. And you can just hook up stuff, just put extra stuff on it. So what does it look like? Okay, first, there's the text encoder. The text encoder reads your commands, right? You give the words to it, and it sits there, and it uses a method, BERT, FLIP, a bunch of other ones. It doesn't simply read the words. It, like, breaks the words up into semantic phonemes and then throws them into this pot in the middle, which is the image information creator. So the image information creator takes the encoded words and then just starts throwing bits of random junk at them. Just kind of again and again and again. And is it getting closer to what seems to be happening? Yeah, this is the generation process. There's first the one that just does it on a very small scale, just kind of 64 by 64, just to get like a rough sketch. And when that passes, it throws it over to an entirely different machine that tries to blow it up a little bigger. Again, 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 like throwing sponges at the wall. It never draws a straight line. It never paints. It never photographs. It just throws bits of statistical pixels onto a screen, and then a bigger screen, and then yet a bigger screen. And then at the end, it's passed on to yet another machine, which is the image decoder or auto encoder decoder, which is kind of an art critic. And it just sits there looking at all the spew that's come out of these other machines. Dozens of images, maybe hundreds, and it just ruthlessly gets rid of the ones that don't seem to make any sense. And then at the end of this process, it'll show you five or six images. So that's what an image generator is. There's no pencils, there's no lenses, there's no rule, there's no rulers, there's no T-squares. It can't count, it can't see, it can't hear, it has no common sense. But it has a colossal database of image and a command of basically every language on earth. And it's an art device that shows you the most probable thing that's associated with this word and associated with this image. And there's never been anything in the history of the world that could behave like that. It's not a general AI, but it is really a new thing. And, you know, it's already massive. People are throwing huge amounts of money in it. But it's moving so quickly that I feel that I can promise you 2 years from now at the next Biennale, you're going to know all about this and you're even going to be a little bored. Right? I mean, there's going to be a craze over it that ranks with, like, the craze for non-fungible tokens and cryptocurrency. Which, you know, last year during the pandemic, people were just coming out of their skins about it. Everybody was super interested. Okay, amazing amounts of money and talent are going to be thrown at this thing. It's wonderful right now. It's truly just, you know, an awe-inspiring wonder. But people are going to get bored. And also they're going to use it for particularly clumsy and degraded things. Ads, spam, pornography, you know, the worst. It's so cheap and so fast that it's going to be used for incredibly cheap and fast and cruddy applications. So, you know, somebody's going to have to figure out what actually good generated art looks like. Okay, it's not going to be Silicon Valley. Might be Berlin. Paris will probably have something to say about it. Not going to be the Chinese, although they're going to be working very hard. The Japanese don't like it. They're kind of up in arms about it. They're really immorally upset. I'm thinking Torito could be a player here. I don't know. I mean, you've got very good taste in art, and you've got like a long tradition of doing this sort of thing. And if you actually wanted to sort of say, look, you know, we can like actually curate this, it's a great opportunity for you.
And the last image we had was, maybe we can generate it with words, you know, here just, because yeah. What's very interesting is that the words generate images. And since I'm like, I don't have a mother language, I don't have a first language, and I translate a lot of, you know, untranslatable authors like Gadda.
Can you see this?
Yeah, look.
Okay, this is what it provides if you ask for a labyrinth, right?
Yeah.
Okay, everybody who's a human being knows what a labyrinth is. It's like a puzzle where you go in from one side and you try to find your way out the other side. Okay, a generator doesn't know what space is. This is a generator's labyrinth. It's just a bunch of circles that look like a labyrinth. It's not actually a puzzle because it can't be puzzled. It doesn't have any, you know, it doesn't have the capacity to be surprised in that way.
Yeah. It's the words. They understand the words properly because it's an artificial intelligence which doesn't know. You see, the labyrinth is a symbol of life and death. You have an entrance when you are born. Then, you know, that's life in the middle. And then you go out, exit, you know, it's the final exit, you know. But since the artificial intelligence doesn't know that there is the difference between life and death, it's just a flat circle, you know, without all the drama that's involved in a labyrinth. So I have this famous saying, you know the philosopher Simone Weil, you know, she was writing about politics mostly, but she had something a phrase I loved very much, which was like, I applied it to the war situation.
The beauty of the world is the mouth of a labyrinth.
Yeah. And also she used to say, when all the moral and ethic values have collapsed and you don't know what to think because you live, like, for example, in a Nazi society or something like that, what do you do? Because artificial intelligence doesn't have moral, doesn't have ethics. You know, we have to do something about it. You touch your pulse like this, and you say, this is right, this is wrong, according to your emotions. And she was not like, she was a very intelligent person.
Well, you know, the beauty of the world is the mouth of the labyrinth is a very literary thing to say. But in the terms of this image, even though these are very beautiful, very beautiful images of labyrinths, they're not actually labyrinths, right? Because the thing doesn't have any purpose. I mean, there's no story, right? It doesn't realize that a labyrinth is something you can wander into and get lost in and then find your way out of. That's really our job, you know? I mean, it's like me and Yasmina, we like do this all the time, you know? And we're not afraid of this particular labyrinth. On the contrary, we can live in Torino. We can live anywhere, okay? We're the kind of people who go, like, build a house in the labyrinth. We don't care. We'll put a tent in there, you know? It's like, come on by. We're gonna have plenty to show you, really. We're going to have plenty to show you in this labyrinth, one of the most interesting labyrinths of my lifetime. It's really been just a cool thing to see. So thank you for your attention.
And come to our show.
Thank you. We have 6 minutes or so, I guess, to answer to some questions. I mean, you raised up lots of things, and even without the images, it was pretty clear how big this thing is going to be.
Well, you know, I was looking at the Miyazaki show earlier, and, you know, I have a feeling like hand-drawn cartoon animation may not be long for this world. It's just so easy to generate cells with these that it's going to be very hard. And you can generate them in infinite detail and colossal size at zero cost. And it's going to be very hard for... But, you know, animators have systems that are kind of generative anyway. I mean, they tend to, like, draw the cell and then just reproduce it again and again. They're going to adapt this very quickly, and we're going to have very vivid, very big animations that are simply not drawn. They're just, but you know, you can put like the plotted characters on them and do movies, you know, and the price point is going to collapse. I mean, any college student's going to be able to do stuff that makes Miyazaki's detailing look sick.
And how can we, I mean, or do we need to define what creative will be? Because the tools are so simple, or seem so simple, because then you're not fully in control, because words are in control, and words can be misunderstood very frequently by these systems.
I think the answer there
Who's going to become a master?
Yeah, well, you're gonna get generative artists who are pure generative artists, like people in the Casey Rees school, who actually want to do generative motion graphics, right? I mean, they're into the aesthetics of you know, kind of abstract program motion. But when it comes to commercial uses of these systems, people are going to use them and then just immediately ship them into Photoshop, and fix the parts that they don't like, and kind of, you know, they'll tinker with them. It's going to be rare to see a completely generated image. I mean, even this isn't a completely generated image. It's got titles on it, typography on it. You still needed an art director to put all the stuff in the back. You're going to see plenty more like this, but it's not going to be left with the generative artist as the only person involved. There's always going to be some human value add slapped onto it here and there.
Cool. Sì.
Bueno. Hi. Thank you for your presentation. That was wonderful. So I have two questions. The first one is about the novelty. So you think that through simple recombination, you cannot get to novelty. That seems to be your position. And the other one is, why do Japanese do not like that? That was fascinating for me.
Well, what actually happened in Japan, which is quite interesting, is that a lot of anime artists like Miyazaki saw that their work had simply been eaten up wholesale by these American, you know, big tech outfits, and their permission had not been asked. And, you know, anime is very popular all over the world, so they see it as just like literally a foreign assault. I mean, people just came and stole it, as if you'd gone and like copied every Samusen sound and then like made a, you know, made a techno album using, you know, samples of Japanese artists. So they're going to sue. I mean, there's, you know, and they will win in the Japanese courts, right? And this is not something you're going to necessarily expect, but yeah, I mean, there's going to be generated art, right? And then in terms of originality, I mean, this is a metaphysical problem, right? Like, okay, is it an original thought? I mean, I would refer to you to James Bridle. He wrote these essays about new aesthetics about 10 years ago, where he said that if you want to look at things in the 21st century that look like nobody else's art ever looked, you need to look at computer-generated art, or even just computer-generated imagery, things like glitches, you know, frozen screens. These are things that are in our surroundings every day that nobody in the 20th century would even have words for, right? And we don't recognize them as our original contribution to world culture, but a lot of these things are. I mean, and they're very much of our period, like 8-bit pixel art, right? I mean, nobody makes it. It's archaic now, but it's very much a part of the 1980s and 1990s. And as soon as you show it, people just kind of recognize it. So nobody at the time said it was original, but seen from behind, it actually looks very original. It's like nobody else ever did that. There's like this very brief cultural moment where this is like the hippest technical thing you can do. And then like 6 years later, it's antique, it's dead. And the same is true of generated art right now. It's so bad, you know, with the hand problems and the innumeracy. It can't read letters. It can't read words. It doesn't know the meaning of words that it generates. That it's doing like really weird art that we will not be able to make it at all in another 5 years. And so it's going to look really original. Like, holy cow, this is from like the early tidal wave of generative art, but it's going to look like glitch and sort of weirdly crude. You know, okay, you know, how original is that? I mean, that's a good question. And like, okay, if you're a curator, where are you supposed to put that, right? Or if you're an art historian, it's like, what do you do with it, right? And you know, these are not new questions in the technology world. We got a lot of colleagues working on this, storing stuff, displaying it. Very difficult. What do you do with a piece of generated art? Do you sell it as an NFT? Do you frame it? Right? Do you tattoo it on yourself? Right? Like, all right, do you do a poster of it? Okay, they're just JPEGs. Right? I mean, they look like every kind of art from every historical period and every place on the planet, but they're not paintings. They're not sculptures. They're not analog. They're literally glowing things on a screen. Like, you know, blue earring girl. That's not the blue earring girl. That's a JPEG of the blue earring girl.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your speech. And I have a kind of naive question, maybe. But you kind of outlined it through your speech. That I had a question about how do you see the link between language and the real and reality in this notion that, for example, a language cannot represent, for example, you, no matter if, I don't know how many pages describes you, it won't ever be able to describe you as a person in total. Thank you very much.
You know, I actually think Yasmina should tackle that because she's a translator doing a lot of language work. You know, he's asking what's the relationship between language and like the reality that's being expressed by these systems. Because you can talk to them in several languages.
Yeah. Well, you know, I will just tell you a very strange experience that I had with like a person without the first language and somebody who translates, no? Since I translated difficult authors. I learned a lot that once you translate, you very often rewrite everything, you know, because you can't keep to the language. But I learned also the opposite, that sometimes it's really nice to literally translate something because you learn, you input in the new language, in the other language, something from the other language, new metaphors, you know, which are understandable. So what I did in writing my own books, now this is really interesting, is that I would write them in one language, then I would translate them in another language, and then I would retranslate them in the third languages because I had, literally three languages, and then I would go back to the first languages. By the time I go back to the first languages I wrote, it was a different book, you know, but better. It got clean, it got original, you know, like it has, like if I tell you, buono come la casa, if you translate it into Serbian, means nothing. You know, or the word home, you know, which you have in English, different from house, you know. You don't have it in many languages, you see. So I think that it's, we have to be attentive what we're going to do with the language, with the artificial intelligence. But we can also learn a lot going back from them to us, you know. This is what I think, how I learned a lot from other languages creating an artificial Serbian or artificial Italian. And my editors often would say, no, you can't say it in this way. I said, look, if you understand it, it has to be that way, you know. But I have quarrels all the time, you know. Yes.
Microphone.
You don't have a mic.
Well, I'm very sorry, but by language, I meant the language itself, no matter, I mean, it is French, Italian, mm-hmm. or anything. By language, I mean, for example, it doesn't matter how much I, for example, describe you as a person or me as a person, 1,000 pages, it never, never, never can describe me as a person because, for example, I can show it to another person over here
right.
who doesn't know me.
Yeah.
So at the end, he cannot imagine who I am. So language is impossible to describe. It's impossible.
Yeah,
there's
actually a toy system online right now that's doing that. It's called Clip Interrogator. And if you put your picture in there, it will describe you as a prompt. And then you can put the prompt in a generator, and it will generate somebody who looks like you.
But it's not yet.
But never exactly like you, somewhat like you. You know, and the language thing, I mean, I'm an author, so I could, like, go into this all day. These systems don't understand semantics. They don't read. Like GPT-3, Generative Pre-trained Transformer 3, really great at languages, do 75 languages at once for 100,000 users at a time, but it's not a reader. What it's doing is assembling statistical clusters of texts.
But maybe if you say some words, it can interpret who you are, you know, because you would say different words from what I would say in a different... Yeah, no, it is random.
When you give a generator a prompt, it doesn't read it. It generates from it. So that there's a generative, there's a prompt artist on Twitter is a woman who calls herself Rivers Have Wings. And she's been very active in this. You know, she's a programmer as well as an artist. And Rivers Have Wings is a great prompt because a human being would not do anything with that. But if I tell an artist, I want you to paint a river with wings, it's like, okay, that's absurd. But a generator will immediately do it. And it'll do something that doesn't look like anything any human ever imagined. It won't be original, but it's going to be just really out there. I mean, just like, what the hell, right? Because it doesn't care. I mean, the phoneme rivers and the phoneme wings and the connecting word with, that does not bother it. Nonsense does not bother it. You can put in a chain of numbers and letters, and it'll try to do something. So, yeah, it's got weird limits, but it also has like aspects of expansion that are just beyond the human in really surprising ways. And, you know, my feeling is that as we understand it better, that's where the actual art is going to come from. People who understand that it's not a method to mimic human artists or to do style transfer. It's actually a way to explore the phase space of all possible images. Well, it's free sometimes. Yeah.
You began by posing the question that you face curating this vast output of material. Doesn't it seem that the value proposition for the future is the branding that a curator of distinction puts on these images?
Yeah, well, you know, who's like doling out the Walter Benjamin aura, right? And who's like assembling the canon? You know, and things get historically reassessed all the time. So this is kind of a fluid thing. But, you know, somebody's actually got to do this dirty work. I mean, even if it's humanly impossible, you know, it's kind of like beach combing. Like, okay, you're going to the beach, you want to bring home pretty shells. All right, there's 80 billion shells out there. And oceans and oceans and oceans. So what are you going to do? Well, you know, you could despair and not go to the beach. Or else you could just go to the beach and kind of do your best. You know, and like hang out with other beach combers and sort of say, what seems to be the rare ones and what seems to be like the cool ones, right? Like, okay, that's our situation right now.
Have you derived any principles of curation?
We have principles at Share Festival for things that we're going to show to the Turinese public, and I actually think that's kind of where you put your feet on the ground. I mean, you as an aesthetician, you can be like Goethe and write a book about the emotional meanings of colors, which is, you know, a famous book and artists really like it, and you know, that's a great work of aesthetic theory. But I think it's actually better to have this kind of grain of the material when you think, okay, we're like public servants and we have people who really are Turinese and they're an intelligent group of creative people with a technological and industrial bent. I mean, they really like tools, hardware, and so forth. What can we show them that's like actually going to help them out, right? Just like, okay, what's going to like catch their particular imagination? All right, they need to know that Brian Eno is in the Venereia. Right? I mean, we're going to curate that. It's not the most famous work of generative art in the world, but it's the most famous work of generative art that was ever here in Turin. And you could do it tomorrow. Venereia is wide open. You know, it took cost nothing. You could generate anything. You know, it's like paint stuff on the walls. I've seen it done. Every day we tell them to do it. Here's a bag of tools. Go do it. Paint the mole. Set it on fire. Come on.
Thank you. A big applause for... Oh, I think we are done. One last question. Okay, one last question.
Sorry. My question is, the generative models can have own style. For example, all the artists have their own style, and this is kind of hard. They began with the influence by other artists, after then their prime time they can have their own style. For generative models can have their own styles?
Well, there's like AlphaZero, right, which plays chess and Go. So, you know, it's a game machine, but it can defeat any human being, and it can also defeat any previous chess engine. Because it's a deep learner. It's a neural net, and it's crushed all previous forms of chess playing machinery. And there are chess experts who say that it has an original style. You know, it actually plays like AlphaZero, and AlphaZero doesn't play like any other human being or machine. But AlphaZero took over the chess world something like, what, maybe 8 years ago, and its style has not improved. It doesn't get better. You know, it doesn't innovate. It just kind of learned how to beat everything, and nobody can even measure how good it is. It doesn't have an international chess ranking because there's nothing that compares to it, right? So, you know, it's there and it's different, but it's not. It doesn't have style in the way that a person has style because it's not expressive. It can't change its style. It doesn't have any reason to get better, right? Yeah, you know, and these, you know, it has a catalog of all possible styles, and you can mix them very easily, like draw the Mona Lisa in the style of Aubrey Beardsley. You know, it can do that in a hot second, but it doesn't have any reason to generate a contemporary style that would express itself as a creative figure in the world, because it's not a creative figure. It's just a generator, right? It's as if you'd automated a huge number of robot sponges to go out and just paint the world with little colored dots. Okay, they do a terrific job and it would look great at the end, but that's not style as human beings understand. You know, I hope that answers your question. I mean, it's a little vague. It wouldn't absolutely shock me if one of these things came up with a style. Like, I think GPT-4 has kind of a verbal style. You know, when I'm reading GPT-4 text, I can like sense that it talks like a particular kind of author, but it doesn't actually say anything. It doesn't have any motive, right? And it doesn't have any human limits. It will just tell you stuff as long as you want, right? So, you know, if you could write 1 million books in 10 minutes, which you can do, you're going to be hard put to be a stylist. You know, does not compute. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you again.
Very patient.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you, Yasmina. Bye-bye.